We're diving into some pretty intense family dynamics this time around, Tocqueville, and his almost like obsession with the Bonapartes. It wasn't just an academic thing for him, was it?
Oh, absolutely not. It's intensely personal. I mean, you see it throughout his work, this constant wrestling with France's past, present, and future, and always those Bonapartes looming large, right? His family history is like a microcosm of this whole struggle.
Well, and speaking of family, his family tree reads like a who's who of the French Revolution and Napoleonic eras. I mean, you've got his great-grandfather right there on the chopping block during the Terror, then an uncle who served Napoleon, resisted Napoleon, like, what a life. And then even his own brothers end up backing Napoleon III.
Oh, imagine those family dinners. I mean, talk about awkward. But seriously, you can see how these divisions within his own family would spark that curiosity in him, that need to understand what made the Bonapartes so appealing and enduring, even to people he loved, you know?
It's like he's trying to diagnose France itself, trying to figure out how a nation goes through all that upheaval, revolution, terror, empire, back to revolution, and then seems to just like repeat the cycle all over again, you know?
That's it, exactly. And a lot of it, he starts to realize, comes down to this idea of administrative centralization. It's something he actually argued with his own father about. His father, he bought into this idea that Napoleon, well, he perfected it, took this messy, fragmented kingdom and left a streamlined, efficient state. But Tocqueville, not so much.
Well, right, because Tocqueville's seen firsthand how that kind of centralized authority plays out on the ground. It's one thing on paper, but in reality, it chokes off local autonomy, silences individual voices.
Exactly. And this is key to understanding Tocqueville because he's already grappling with these questions when he heads off to America.
And that's where Democracy in America comes in.
Yeah.
But it's almost like he's not really writing about America, is he? I mean, it's as if he's holding up this like idealized vision of America as a mirror to France, and in the reflection, you can't escape Napoleon's shadow.
You've hit the nail on the head. That's Tocqueville, always with the comparisons. He sees America's decentralized structure, the way local governance is so deeply ingrained in the culture, and it becomes this model, this almost idealized vision, as you said, of what France could have been.
It's like he's saying, look, here's a path we could have taken. Here's what a society looks like when it embraces decentralization, values individual liberty and self-government. And he's doing all of this while seeming to just be praising a new nation.
It's a brilliant, if subtle, critique of Napoleon's legacy. And this is where his anxieties about administrative centralization really come into focus, right? Because he sees that efficiency, that supposed strength of a centralized state, it comes at a steep price, individual liberty. And in America, he sees the opposite, this vibrancy, the energy that comes from allowing a diversity of viewpoints to flourish, letting people have a real say in how their communities are run.
And it's interesting, because in a way, Tocqueville's anxieties about centralization, they feel like surprisingly relevant today, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about it. Big data, government surveillance, the power of tech giants. It's like Tocqueville was prophetic, warning us about the dangers of unchecked centralized power, no matter what form it takes.
Yeah, and yet you have to remember, in his own time, he was kind of a lone voice, right? I mean, Napoleon's legacy, it wasn't ancient history. It was still casting this long shadow over France.
Absolutely. And this is where his famous speech at the French Academy comes in. It's 1842, and Louis-Philippe, he's in power, and what's he doing? He's trying to boost his own legitimacy by, reviving all things Napoleon, parades, monuments, you name it.
It's like Napoleon becomes the ultimate marketing campaign.
Right. And Tocqueville sees right through it.
And he chooses this moment, this speech at the French Academy of all places, to take down the whole Napoleon myth.
Right.
Bold move.
It was a calculated risk for sure. But he does it in a very clever way. Instead of directly attacking Napoleon, he chooses to analyze the life of this Napoleonic official, a guy named Sessac.
Sessac's not really the point, is he? He's a stand-in for the whole system.
Exactly. And Tocqueville uses him brilliantly. He writes, and I'm paraphrasing here, that Sessac had all the talent you could want in a Napoleonic official, ambition, ruthlessness, no scruples to speak of, but he never quite makes it to the top. And Tocqueville quips, what Sessac lacked was a theater in which to perform.
Ouch. It's a burn disguised as literary criticism.
It's Tocqueville at his best, but it cuts deep because he's getting at something essential about the nature of power under Napoleon. It's this idea that the system breeds a certain type of person, someone who thrives on ambition, on climbing the ladder, no matter the cost.
And the cost, as Tocqueville sees it, is huge.
Yeah.
It's the soul of France itself.
Exactly. He argues that Napoleon's rule, for all its talk of glory and order, it actually erodes the very foundations of a healthy society. You have blind obedience to an absolute ruler, the crushing of individual liberty, and of course, the perfecting of that administrative centralization that Tocqueville finds so abhorrent.
It's like this poison that seeps into everything.
That's a great way to put it. And what's tragic is that within just a few years of this speech, France finds itself right back in that cycle with the rise of, who else? Napoleon III.
Ah, yes, the nephew. Because one Bonaparte clearly wasn't enough. But what's striking here, isn't it, is that Tocqueville himself, he actually advocated for a strong presidency after the 1848 revolution.
Hmm.
He even served on the committee to draft the new constitution.
He did, yeah. It's one of those great ironies of history, right? Because in that moment, in the aftermath of the revolution, Tocqueville, he believes that a strong executive is just what France needs to maintain stability, to prevent another cycle of chaos and violence. And he even pushes for term limits, thinking, well, this will be the guardrail. This will stop another Bonaparte from grabbing power.
But he underestimates both Louis Napoleon's ambition and, let's face it, the French public's deep desire for stability, even if it means sacrificing some of that hard-won liberty.
Exactly. And Louis Napoleon, he's a shrewd operator. He knows how to exploit that desire for stability, how to tap into the nostalgia for his uncle's reign. He's offering a return to glory, to order. And for a lot of people in France, exhausted by years of upheaval, it's a message that resonates all too well.
And of course, it all culminates in the coup of December 1851. Did Tocqueville see it coming?
He definitely had his suspicions, but even he is taken aback by the sheer audacity of it, by how quickly and effectively Louis Napoleon seizes control.
And it's a gut punch, isn't it? To see this repeat of history, to watch as liberty is snuffed out yet again. How does Tocqueville process this? What's his response?
You really feel it in his writing from this point forward, this sense of, I don't know, almost a disillusionment, a realization that maybe France, maybe it's just stuck in this cycle, you know?
And it's in the midst of this disillusionment that he starts working on the old regime and the revolution, right? But he's not just, like, looking back for nostalgia's sake.
Oh, no, not at all. This is Tocqueville with his X-ray vision, right? He's trying to see beneath the surface to understand the root causes of despotism. He wants to connect the dots between the old monarchy, the terror, Napoleon, and now Napoleon III.
He's looking for the common thread.
Exactly. And what he finds is, well, it's a bit unsettling. He realizes that the Bonapartes, they didn't invent a new system of oppression. They just, like, they perfected a very old recipe.
A recipe. That's a chilling way to put it. What are the ingredients in this recipe for despotism?
Well, you start with a heaping helping of centralized power. Then you sprinkle in a healthy dose of suppressing any kind of dissent. And finally, you top it off with a generous portion of exploiting public fear.
And these were all tactics that were alive and well long before the Bonapartes showed up.
Oh, absolutely. The Bourbons used them. The revolutionaries during the terror, they used them. It's all there. And Napoleon, well, he mastered the recipe, took it to new levels.
So Tocqueville's saying that these tendencies, they're like baked into the cake of French society. That they're just waiting for the right moment, the right leader to rise to the surface again.
That's his terrifying realization, and it's one that resonates even today. He suggests that, in a way, France's long love affair with centralization, with this idea that a strong hand at the helm is the only way to ensure order, well, it made them uniquely vulnerable to the allure of Bonaparte, you know?
And it makes you wonder if maybe we're all more susceptible to this than we'd like to admit. That desire for stability, for security, it can be so seductive, especially in times of fear and uncertainty.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, Tocqueville's most enduring warning to us. It's not enough to have good laws, good institutions. If the spirit of a society, if its people are willing to trade their liberty for the promise of security, well, despotism, it's always waiting in the wings.
It's a sobering thought.
Yeah.
The challenge to look inward, to examine our own assumptions about power, about liberty, about the trade-offs we're willing to make. And ultimately, it's a reminder that the fight for a free society, it's never truly over. It's a constant struggle, a choice that each generation has to make.